got out, he would improve the quality of life. Plus Alex, a 42-year-old neo-Nazi who has corresponded with Manson for years, says his discovery of Manson can only be compared to his earlier discovery of Adolf Hitler and the National Socialist Party. He calls Manson the foremost revolutionary leader in the world today, and is special by virtue of a 1 in 100 million shot of gene combinations that gives him his ideas, personality, and physical presence. To the extremists, mass murderers like John Wayne Gacy and Jeffrey Dahmer are no more intriguing than they are to the average citizen. They are merely very sick psychopaths who kill for no reason other than to satisfy their unchecked homicidal urges. Though these killers attract inevitable media attention and interest for a while, they have no followers nor anything to say, and if and when they do talk, not even the extremists listen. The only message these homicidal monsters have to give by their violence is horror. Manson and his murders, on the other hand, are downright hip to the extremists. As misdirected as it was, his violence was political, revolutionary, and therein lies his main appeal to those on the fringes. Also, aware of the flat intellect of most mass killers, the extremists admire and are impressed with Manson's unquestioned intelligence, the offbeat and sometimes searing nature of his insights, his enigmatic answers and allusions, and a mental deftness that allows him to speak in riddles, always with an underlying message. In short, they are drawn to the mystery of Manson. While a Manson-esque culture and mystique grow outside his prison walls, Charles Manson, inmate ID number B-33920 and now 59, is incarcerated at Corcoran State Prison in Corcoran, California, a town of approximately 9,000 people located in the San Joaquin Valley of Central California, 60 miles south of Fresno. Corcoran is built on what was once Tulare Lake, home of the Tachi Indians. Transferred from San Quentin's death row to Folsom State Prison near Sacramento on October 6, 1972, Manson was sent to the California Medical Facility at Vacaville on March 20, 1974, back to Folsom on October 22, 1974, back to San Quentin on June 7, 1975, and back to Vacaville on May 11, 1976, where he remained until July 17, 1985, his longest stay at one prison. He returned to San Quentin on July 18, 1985, and was sent to his present location, Corcoran, on March 15, 1989. Tip Kindle, public information officer for the California Department of Corrections, says the reason for all the transfers of Manson is that Manson has been both a disciplinary and a security problem for the department. It would appear that the fame and outlaw reputation Manson acquired far and wide for the Tate LaBianca murders has had a measurable effect upon how he perceives himself, causing him to act much more belligerently behind bars. Though he was never a model prisoner, I could find no reference in his prison records during his many years of incarceration before the murders of any assaultive behavior by him against prison personnel. But Kindle reports that since Manson's conviction for the murders, he has physically assaulted prison staff, striking them with his hands, throwing hot coffee or expectorating on them, etc., 6 times, the last time in February of 1992, and threatened them on numerous other occasions. Altogether, Manson has been found guilty of 59 CDC 115s, California Department of Corrections disciplinary write-ups. For the past year, however, according to an official at Corcoran, Manson has not been disruptive and hasn't gotten into any trouble. Prison counselor Ernest Cauldron observes that Manson has a pattern of cycling in his behavior. There are brief periods of cooperation, and then he turns and threatens staff, particularly the inexperienced, with violent behavior. In 1972 and 1973, while at Folsom, Manson himself was assaulted on 2 separate occasions by fellow inmates. And a California state prison official says that throughout the years, reports have reached prison personnel that one prison gang or another had a contract on Charlie. However, The only known attempt on his life was while Manson was at the California Medical Facility at Vacaville. The primary reason for sending Manson there was not because of the psychiatric facilities, as many imagined, but because it is considered to be the best place in the California correctional system to take care of a special prisoner like Manson. Vacaville, for the most part, houses the weaker segment of the prison population, those who, because of their physical or mental disability, are more apt to be victims than predators behind bars. On September 25, 1984, it was Manson's misfortune to be working in the hobby shop at Vacaville with one Jan Holmstrom, a member of the Hare Krishna religious group serving a life sentence for the 1974 shotgun murder of his father, a Pasadena gynecologist. In an ironic scene reminiscent of the Manson murders, Holmstrom wrote "Baby Killer" in blood on a wall of the family home. Holmstrom doused Manson with paint thinner and then set him on fire, causing second- and third-degree burns to nearly 20% of his body, mostly his face, scalp, and hands. Holmstrom, described by prison officials as a psychiatric case in remission, said he set Manson ablaze because Manson had objected to his Hare Krishna chants and had threatened him for his religious beliefs. He also claimed, "God told me to kill Manson." True solitary confinement does not exist in the California prison system today. Inmates still use the popular term, however, to refer to the situation where no other inmate shares their cell with them, and they are segregated from the general prison population, mingling only with selected prisoners. Manson has spent the majority of his 23 years of incarceration for the Tate-LaBianca, Shea, and Hinman murders in this type of housing. At Vacaville in August of 1980, Manson was given his first prison job, gardener and maintenance man for the Protestant chapel. "It's taken me 10 years to get a breath of fresh air," he said. "I'm not about to screw up." Maintaining a clean disciplinary record for close to 2 years, in June of 1982 he was placed, per his request, on the main line, the general prison population. Manson's resolve not to screw up lasted, or the lack of it remained undiscovered, until October 29, 1982, when a hacksaw blade, along with marijuana, was found in his cell. Also, upon his arrival back at San Quentin from Vacaville in 1985, a 4-inch piece of a hacksaw blade was found in his shoe. How does one reconcile Manson's apparent interest in escaping with his desire at Terminal Island in 1967 to stay behind bars? Prison had become his home, he told the authorities back then, and he didn't think he could adjust to the world outside. Even today, I suspect that Manson isn't miserable or even unhappy behind bars. Having spent 42 of his 59 years in jails, reformatories, and prisons, he obviously has become totally institutionalized, and therefore most likely isn't uncomfortable in an incarcerated setting per se. However, after he got out in 1967, he undoubtedly learned to like having a harem of girls. "Up in the hate, I'm called the gardener. I tend to all the flower children," he had told Squeaky when they first met, "and riding dune buggies up and down the desert, more." Further, like never before, Manson now has to look over his shoulder. He knows that any con who wants to make a name for himself can kill him, and then he becomes famous. A subsequent search of the chapel uncovered 4 bags of marijuana, 100 feet of nylon rope, and a mail-order catalog for hot air balloons. If Manson couldn't hack his way out of prison, he apparently was thinking of flying the coop. In what must be considered a vapid display, prison officials actually asked the state attorney general's office to file possession of marijuana charges against the man serving 9 concurrent life sentences for 9 murders, but saner counsel prevailed and no charges were filed. While at Vacaville, Manson refused to take part in group psychiatric therapy and largely just played word games with psychiatrists during the individual sessions he consented to. One psychiatric evaluation of Manson made by prison doctors stated, "He has above-average intelligence, and the Rorschach test drawings seem to point to schizophrenia. This doesn't mean his entire performance was schizophrenic. Manson is a passive-aggressive personality with paranoid tendencies. Manson's response? Sure, I'm paranoid. I've had reason to be ever since I can remember, and now I have to be just to stay alive. As for schizophrenia, take anybody off the streets and put them in the middle of a prison and you'll see all kinds of split personalities. I've got 1,000 faces, so that makes me 500 schizophrenics. And in my life I've played every one of those faces, sometimes because people push me into a role, and sometimes because it's better being someone else than me. After spending a short time in the psychiatric ward at Vacaville, Manson was transferred out on the recommendation of a psychiatric report which said he was nothing but a psychiatric curiosity or oddity. Knowing he may well spend the rest of his life in prison, Manson has either boycotted his parole hearings since his first one in 1978, or used them merely as a forum to sermonize or simply have some fun. In 1978, he regaled the parole board with his comments for 3 hours. I'm totally unsuitable for that world out there. I don't fit in at all, a bearded and shaggy-haired Manson allowed in saying he should not be released from prison. But then Manson, never a model of consistency, added, I'm mad. I'm indignant. I'm mad to every bone in my body that I have to come back to the penitentiary when I didn't break no law. Waving his arms in exclamation and half-singing his presentation, Manson said, I'm not your executioner. I'm not your devil and I'm not your God. I'm Charles Manson. Reminding the board he had spent most of his life behind bars, he said, I was born and raised all my life in prison. He told the board he had been asked to come to Scotland, Germany, Australia, but that he wasn't interested. When asked where he would go if released, he responded, I'd go to the desert, talk to the animals, and live off the land. The parole board, in denying parole, said that Manson's crime eclipses the imagination. The following year, Manson sent word from his cell that he had nothing to tell the board and gave his unit sergeant several $100 bills from a Monopoly set and a chance card that said, Advance to go, collect $200, to deliver to the board members. Delighting in talking to reporters covering his parole hearings, he told one, You're in prison more than I am. You've got more rules to live by than I do. I can sit down and relax. Can you? Grabbing another reporter's arm and pressing his mouth close to her ear, he whispered, Do you know a way out of here? If you get me out, we can go to the desert, and I'll show you things that'll blow your mind. At his parole hearing in 1981, Manson, in a T-shirt with a small skull and crossed bones, repeatedly stood, sat down, paced, and interrupted the hearing, frequently shouting at the board members. He told the board, I've been in solitary for 10 years. I ain't got no mind. It's gone, man. I don't understand half the things you're saying. Then, I never really grew up. I went to prison at 9. I don't read or write too good, and I've stayed like a little kid. I stopped thinking in 1954. In 1986, Manson did not appear at his parole hearing, sending the board instead a lengthy written statement. All of the judgments and the blame that is pushed off on me will be reflected back in the fires of the holy war that you call crime, he wrote. I did invoke a balance for life on earth. From behind the time locks of courtrooms and from the worlds of darkness, I did let loose devils and demons with the power of scorpions to torment. I did unseal 7 seals and 7 jars in accord with the judgments placed upon me. You've drugged me for years, dragging me up and down prison hallways, laying my head on every chopping block you've got, chained me, burnt me, but you cannot defeat me. In the all that was said about me, it was not me saying it, and if you see a false prophet, it is only a reflection of your own judgments. That same year, he wrote President Ronald Reagan at the White House with this advice, Keep projecting to kids what not to do, and you make the thought in their brains of what can and will be done. Before signing off with, Easy, Charles Manson, he told Reagan, I'm the last guy in line, but I've got all the thoughts for the balance of order and peace with a one-world government if we all are to survive. At his last parole hearing on April 21, 1992, Manson, the defiant swastika still very visible on his forehead, responded to the accusation he had ordered the murders by telling the three-man parole board, now called the Board of Prison Terms, "Everyone says that I was the leader of those people, but I was actually the follower of the children. I didn't break God's law, and I didn't break man's law." As with each of his prior appearances before the board, he did virtually all the talking. The most routine questions launched him into unstoppable stream-of-consciousness lectures that contained references to God, the economy, Rambo, the Queen of England, World Wars I and II, the Pope, J. Edgar Hoover, winos, Vietnam, chess, Christian ethics, General MacArthur, President Truman, ninja warriors, the San Diego Zoo, J.R. Ewing, gangster Frank Costello, and a myriad of other people and subjects, including the relationship between does and bucks and dogs and chickens. And as always, that which he always returns to, the need to stop the destruction of the environment. He told the board they live in a matriarchal world, he in a patriarchal one. You back up to your women. I don't back up to my women. Although the details did not emerge, Manson acknowledged at the hearing that he has been getting $500 for his autograph from people on the outside. Manson also receives 10 cents for every Manson T-shirt sold. In California, the profits of convicted criminals can only be seized if the money-making venture is directly related to the crime. The T-shirts and Manson's song in the Guns N' Roses album do not qualify for seizure. Senate Bill 1330, which is presently before the California legislature, would expand the scope of seizure to include the sale of anything the value of which is enhanced by the notoriety gained from the commission of the crime. However, in 1971, the son of Wojtek Frykowski, one of the five Tate victims, got a $500,000 judgment against Manson and his four co-defendants. As a result of a writ of execution on the judgment, with interest worth $1,200,000 in 1994, in late February of 1994, the son, who lives in Germany, received his first royalty check for $72,000 from the Manson song in the Guns N' Roses album. The board, in finding Manson unsuitable for parole, set 1997 for his next hearing, the maximum time, 5 years, between parole hearings allowed under the California Penal Code. Until her death from cancer in July of 1992, Sharon Tate's mother, Doris, attended most of the parole hearings for Manson and his killers, and was successful in mobilizing national support in the form of 352,000 letters to the parole board to keep Manson and the others behind bars for life. "I live with her," Sharon's screams, "and her begging for the life of her baby," she often said. In the late 70s, Mrs. Tate co-founded the Los Angeles chapter of Parents of Murdered Children, a group providing mental, emotional, and other support to its members. Just before her death, Mrs. Tate, who was the United States representative at an international victims' rights conference in Stockholm in June of 1990, formed the Sacramento-based Doris Tate Crime Victims Bureau. The bureau promotes, among other things, the enactment of legislation for the rights of crime victims. Since her mother's passing, Patty Tate, who was 11 years old when her 26-year-old sister was slain, and who bears a striking resemblance to Sharon, has been faithfully and effectively carrying on all of her mother's important work. Speaking of her sister, a misty-eyed Patty says, "She was so sweet and such a gentle soul. I idolized her, and there wasn't anything I wouldn't have done for her." Corcoran is a medium maximum security institution. Manson is housed in the Security Housing Unit, SHU, in a 6.5 by 12.5 foot cell he shares with another inmate. Called a prison within a prison, SHU is the maximum security section at Corcoran. Manson is issued 3 meals a day by correctional officers. The food is served on trays through a food port located in each cell door. Breakfast is at 6:30 a.m., lunch at noon, and dinner at 5 p.m. No less than 10 hours a week he exercises in a nearby walled yard with 10 co-inmates of his. Manson has a radio and television set in his cell, but does not have his beloved guitar, the latter not permitted in SHU. Like all inmates in this unit, he does not have a work assignment. Per the California Department of Corrections, the current annual cost to the taxpayers for housing Manson is $20,525. Manson carries on running correspondence with as many of the people who write to him as he can. He also apparently writes to some who have no desire to be his pen pal, sending 4 letters to me in the preceding years. In 1986, the book Manson in His Own Words, as told to Newell Emmons, was published in hardcover. The thoughts may be Manson's, but the diction clearly is not. Dedicated to destroying a myth, Manson instead tries to perpetuate the myth he and his most ardent followers invented, that the Tate-LaBianca murders were the girl's idea. Manson admits, in a roundabout fashion, that he thereafter ordered the 2 LaBianca killings, but continues to deny ordering the 5 Tate murders on the first night. Near the conclusion of his book, Manson writes, "There are days when I get caught up in being the most notorious convict of all time. In that frame of mind, I get off on all the publicity, and I'm pleased when some fool writes and offers to off some pigs for me. I've had girls come to visit me with their babies in their arms and say, 'Charlie, I'd do anything in the world for you. I'm raising my baby in your image.' Those letters and visits used to delight me, but that's my individual sickness. What sickness is it that keeps sending me kids and followers? It's your world out there that does it. I don't solicit my mail or ask anyone to come and visit me. Yet the mail continues to arrive, and your pretty little flowers of innocence keep showing up at the gate." From these relatively benign words, Manson abruptly changes, and after saying he doesn't think he'll ever be released, closes his book in vintage fashion with these ominously ambiguous words: "My eyes are cameras. My mind is tuned to more television channels than exist in your world, and it suffers no censorship. Through it, I have a world and the universe as my own. So, know that only a body is in prison. At my will, I walk your streets and am right out there among you." Life behind bars hasn't dashed Manson's desire to be a recording star. From his cell in Vacaville in 1982, Manson recorded his 2nd album, titled Charlie Manson's Good Time Gospel Hour. Manson sings ballads he composed about his life and that of his pals on San Quentin's death row. The sounds of nearby television and flushing toilets can be heard in the background. Manson's 1st album, called Lie, the photo on the jacket is the one of him on the December 19, 1969 cover of Life magazine, was taped, portentously, on August 9, 1968, exactly 1 year before the Tate murders. With several of the Manson family girls providing choral backup, Manson sings his own compositions. Both albums have gone through several bootleg editions and are considered such rare collectibles that one alternative music store owner told me if he ever got his hands on either one, I wouldn't sell them. They're too valuable. Remarkably, there are some who heap scalding criticism on those in the music industry who never gave Manson a chance when he got out of prison in 1967. If he had been given a real opportunity, they add, most likely the murders would never have taken place. While this is possibly true, that type of but-for causation could be used to argue that if someone had bought Hitler's paintings in Vienna in 1912, perhaps we wouldn't have had the Second World War. Being behind bars also hasn't inhibited Manson from reaching America's vast television audience. The media, NBC's Today Show, CNN, BBC, Charlie Rose, Tom Snyder, the ABC special in March of 1994, etc., have sought him out, enabling him to verbally spew his venom. In a 1988 interview with Geraldo Rivera, he said, "I'm going to chop up some more of you motherfuckers. I'm going to kill as many of you as I can. I'm going to pile you up to the sky. I figure about 50 million of you. I might be able to save my trees and my air and my water and my wildlife." When Rivera later said, "There's 9 dead people out there," referring to Manson's 9 murder convictions, Manson answered, "There's a lot more than 9, son, a whole lot, and there's going to be a whole lot more." When Rivera asked if he told the women in his family to kill, he responded, "I don't deal with women. I got to tell what to do. They know what to do." He told Rivera, "I make laws. I'm the lawmaker. I'm the one that lays down the track." In the 25 years since the murders, no event thrust the Manson family back into the news once again as much as Lynette Squeaky Frum's attempted assassination of President Gerald Ford in 1975. After Manson was transferred from San Quentin back to Folsom in October of 1974, Squeaky and Sandra Good moved to Sacramento, 15 miles to the west, to be as close to him as possible. Though Squeaky and Sandra were not allowed to visit or even correspond with Manson, a prison spokesman at the time said that the two of them would come to the prison about once a month to inquire about how Manson was doing. A friend of Squeaky and Sandra told Time magazine that the girls believed Manson's imprisonment was part of a grand design, that he would rise again someday like Christ. They spend all their time preparing themselves for the day he rises. Squeaky, Sandra, and a part-time nurse they had recruited into the family named Susan Murphy rented a run-down attic apartment in an old downtown boarding house just a few blocks from the state capitol. On the sunny and crisp morning of September 5th, 1975, President Ford was walking through a park in front of the Capitol to meet Governor Jerry Brown. Not only wasn't Squeaky on the Secret Service's list of dangerous people in town to watch, particularly remarkable when weeks earlier she and Sandra had issued a communique to the media in Sacramento that if Nixon's reality wearing a new face, i.e. Ford, continues to run this country against the law, your homes will be bloodier than the Tate LaBianca homes and me and Lai put together. But the president's men inexplicably paid no attention to an elfish woman nearby attired in a bright red robe and matching turban. The Manson family's hatred of former President Nixon stems, of course, from Nixon's headline-capturing declaration during the trial that he believed Manson to be guilty. In author Ed Sandler's best-selling book, The Family, he quotes a Manson therapist at Vacaville as saying Manson believed his own personal hex on Nixon had caused him to fall. As Ford stopped at a magnolia tree to shake hands with a cluster of smiling supporters, Squeaky materialized out of the group, grabbed a gun from under her robe, and pointed it at Ford, just 2 feet away. Instantly, Secret Service agent Larry Boondorf seized Squeaky's gun arm and threw her to the ground. In apparent anger, Squeaky cried out, "It didn't go off. Can you believe it? It didn't go off." The reason it didn't go off will probably never be known beyond all doubt. To be sure, Squeaky's .45 caliber Army Colt pistol, though loaded with 4 bullets, had no bullet in the chamber ready to be fired. To fire the gun, Squeaky would have first had to pull the slide back on top of the gun to raise a cartridge from the magazine into the firing chamber, which she hadn't done. Had Squeaky mistakenly thought that squeezing the trigger, Boondorf and another witness reported hearing a metallic clicking sound, which could have been the hammer striking the rear of the firing pin, would be enough to fire the weapon? Because of the belief that Squeaky knew how to operate guns, on the documentary Manson, she is seen operating the bolt of a rifle, many people, including some in law enforcement, are convinced she had no intention of hurting Ford. Nevertheless, Prosecutor Duane Keyes, now a Superior Court judge in Fresno, told me he is absolutely positive she had every intent to kill the president, a state of mind the prosecution had to prove to secure a conviction. In any event, Squeaky was now competing for the limelight, at least for a while, with her god, Charlie, making the September 15, 1975 covers of Newsweek and Time magazines. At her federal trial, she was so obstreperous the judge had her removed from the courtroom for most of the proceedings, but not before she told him that one of the issues at the trial was as clear as the piano in the front window of your home, an accurate reference. During jury deliberations, after a 3-week trial in which Squeaky did not testify, a lot of people, juror Robert Convoy recalled, believed that with no cartridge in the chamber, the gun wasn't a weapon. Ultimately, however, the jury found Squeaky guilty of attempting to assassinate Ford. Prior to 1965, presidential assassination was only a state, not a federal crime. The first female in American history so charged and convicted. Squeaky was sentenced to life imprisonment. Was Manson behind the attempt? My instincts from the beginning were that he was not. Though Manson always spoke as if he had no fear of death, telling his followers that death wasn't the end of life, just another high, even beautiful. Living is what scares me. Dying is easy, he'd also say, as well as implying he had been resurrected. I saw firsthand how hard he in fact fought for his life during his 9 1/2 month trial. Having his death sentence removed just 3 years earlier, it made no sense to me that he would risk a new sentence of death against someone as remote to him and his interests as Ford. Prosecutor Keyes also believed that Manson was not involved, and his office found no evidence implicating him. Squeaky, the little orphan Annie-looking matriarch of the family during Manson's forced exile, was probably trying to impress Manson by her act. She had to know that, successful or not in killing Ford, such a spectacular, grandly anti-societal act would be sure to please him. Searching Squeaky's apartment pursuant to a warrant after the attempt on Ford, police found a stack of letters, ready to go, from the International People's Court of Retribution, an impressive-sounding organization whose membership, however, was rather limited: Squeaky, Sandra Good, and Susan Murphy. The letters threatened named corporate executives and U.S. government officials with death if they did not forthwith stop polluting the air and water and destroying the environment. A long list of other addressees was nearby. While on bail after her and Murphy's arrest for conspiring to send threatening communications through the United States mail, Good proceeded to utter, on radio and TV, the same threats, constituting 4 new federal violations of transmitting death threats by way of interstate commerce. Good represented herself at her trial, was convicted on all 5 counts, Murphy on only the conspiracy count, and asked that she be sentenced to the maximum of 25 years. The judge gave her 15. William Shubb, her appointed advisory counsel during the trial, and now a U.S. federal district court judge in Sacramento, says that if she had been agreeable, he is certain a plea could have been negotiated wherein her sentence would have been much less severe. All of Manson's co-defendants in the Tate-LaBianca murders are, like Manson, still behind bars serving their life sentences. Charles Tex Watson, Manson's chief lieutenant at the murder scenes and the principal killer of the Tate-LaBianca victims, has renounced Manson and is presently at Mule Creek State Prison in Ione, California. He was transferred there in April of 1993 from the California Men's Colony, CMC, in San Luis Obispo, where he had been incarcerated since September 1972. At CMC in 1975, Watson, through the ministry of Raymond Hoekstra, a legendary prison evangelist known as Chaplain Ray, became a born-again Christian. As a student chaplain and associate administrator of the Protestant chapel at CMC, Watson baptized, led Bible study groups, and preached to the inmate congregation. In 1980, Watson founded Abounding Love Ministries, ALMS, a California nonprofit corporation which he and his Norwegian wife, Kristen, run. The two married in 1979 and have three children. Ordained as a minister in 1983, Watson receives donations to his ministry of approximately $1,500 per month from people on a national mailing list to whom he sends religious cassette tapes and a Christian newsletter. Watson's 1978 book, Will You Die For Me?, which he wrote with Chaplain Ray, chronicles his life with Manson, the murders, and his ultimate conversion to Christianity. Speaking of Manson, to whom he writes, "I had given myself totally." He says he served the power of death and destruction through one diabolical man who wanted to be God. Believing that Manson was, perhaps still is, possessed by the devil, he says Manson's only interest had been death, but Jesus promised life. A rather startling admission by Watson to his prison psychiatrist was revealed at his last parole hearing in May of 1990. Watson elected to waive his January 1993 parole hearing, stipulating to his unsuitability for parole. The psychiatrist wrote that it had only been during the last 3 years of one-on-one therapy that Watson had begun to truly experience a sense of deep remorse, both for the crime victims and for the families of the crime victims. When a troubled parole board member asked Watson what, then, had he been feeling the previous 18 years, Watson responded, "Well, it's not that I haven't experienced that before, but there's been things happening in my life over the last few years that have really brought it home more so." Watson explained that ever since he became a Christian in 1975, it's been great to know that I have been forgiven by God for what I've done. But I think sometimes we can hide behind that. In the last 3 years, I've had the opportunity to really see myself in a new light, in the sense that I've opened myself up to really look at the crime through other people's eyes, other than just my own. Watson's belated epiphany was brought about in large part, he informed the board, by a somewhat incongruous relationship with Suzanne LaBerge, formerly Suzanne Struthers, Rosemary LaBianca's daughter from a relationship before she met Lino. The thrice married and divorced Suzanne, who was 21 years old at the time of the murders, began visiting Watson at CMC in 1987. She appeared at the 1990 parole hearing and actually made an impassioned plea for the release of her mother's killer, telling the board Watson had atoned for his terrible crimes, had overcome his past by turning to Christ, and no longer was a threat to society. In a June 5, 1994 letter to me, Watson wrote, "With my deepest remorse, I apologize to the people of the world for my part in making Manson what he has become. To the many victims, my heart is full of sorrow for my actions. If anyone should have received the death penalty for their crimes, it was me. I believe that God and His grace gave me a second chance, having a different plan for my life. I have no great ambitions other than allowing the Lord to use me as a testimony, urging others to Christ." While at CMC, Watson completed courses in vocational data processing and office machine repair. His current work assignment at Mule Creek is tier tender, i.e., keeping clean one of the two tiers in the building where he is housed. A prison spokesperson at Mule Creek advises that since Watson's incarceration for the Tate-LaBianca murders, he has received one disciplinary infraction of a minor nature in 1973. He continues to program without incident. Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Leslie Van Houten, like Watson, have each renounced Manson and expressed remorse for the killings. All are still at the California Institution for Women at Frontera. One of only three prisons for women in the state, Frontera has been described by one wag as a college campus with barbed wire around it. Each of the three Manson girls lives in a cottage-like housing unit, two inmates to a unit, at the attractive, well-manicured institution. All three girls have been reviewed for parole consideration and denied 10 times thus far. It is the common consensus that if any of them are ever released, Van Houten will be the first one, primarily because, unlike Atkins and Krenwinkel, she was only involved in the LaBianca, not the Tate murders. Additionally, a well-organized group, Friends of Leslie, consisting of hundreds of supporters, regularly urge her release to the parole board. According to a prison spokesperson, the institutional behavior of the girls is viewed as good. Krenwinkel, in fact, has not received one disciplinary write-up in 23 years, called unusual by a member of the parole board. Their current custody level is medium security. They are each in the general prison population, and reportedly Krenwinkel and Van Houten are closer to each other socially than either one is to Atkins. The most well-known of the girls, Susan Sexy Sadie Atkins, converted to Christianity even before Watson. Through the intercession in early 1974 of former family member Bruce Davis, in prison at Folsom for the Hinman Shea murders, Susan began to contemplate a Christian life. Davis, who had become a born-again Christian, wrote many letters to her, offering guidance and recommending Christian literature, including the New Testament, for her to read. In her 1977 book, Child of Satan, Child of God, written with Bob Slosser, she recounts an evening in late September 1974 when, alone in her cell, she softly but solemnly uttered the words that she wanted to be forgiven for her ghastly crimes. Suddenly, she writes, there in my thoughts was a door. It had a handle. I took hold of it and pulled. When the door opened, she says, a flood of brilliant light poured over her. In the center was an even brighter light, which she knew was Jesus. He spoke to me, literally, plainly, in my 9x11 prison cell. Susan, I am really here. I'm coming in your heart to stay. Right now you are being born again. You are now a child of God. You are washed clean, and your sins have all been forgiven. Atkins goes on to say that that night, for the first time in many years, she slept soundly, free of nightmares, unafraid and warm. On the last page of her book, she writes that she believes the Lord will one day release me from this place, Frontera, and give me a ministry to people of all kinds, but especially those who are as twisted and lost as I was from my earliest teen years. She now denies stabbing Sharon Tate, adding, however, that her moral culpability is still the same because she was there and did nothing to stop it. When she was asked by a reporter in the mid-80s if she would be willing to say she was sorry to Sharon Tate's mother for her involvement in Sharon's murder, she replied, "There are no words to describe what I feel. I'm sorry, please forgive me. Those words are so overused and inadequate for what I feel." Atkins married one Donald Lee LeJour, a 52-year-old Texan, in September of 1981. LeJour spells his last name with a dollar sign for the S. At the time of the marriage, he claimed to be worth $999 million plus, and seven times that in foreign countries, and he said he planned to build a $12 million solar home near the Frontera prison so he could be close to his bride. Per news reports, LeJour appeared for the wedding in the prison chapel, resplendent and bespangled in diamond rings, diamond clips, a huge gold belt buckle, sunglasses, cigar, Western-style hat, and an orange leisure suit. Atop his rust-colored Cadillac in the prison parking lot outside was an unfurled Lone Star flag of the state of Texas. Although Susan had corresponded with LeJour for several years, there were two small details she regrettably had not learned about him. His wealth was non-existent. Perhaps more importantly, LeJour had the troubling habit of getting married about as often as Paris changes skirt lengths. Susan was his 36th bride. 3 months later, she told LeJour, who had had conjugal visits with her in the prison family living unit apartments, to go back to Texas, concluding the marriage was a drastic mistake. LeJour filed for divorce the following year. In 1987, Susan remarried. Her husband, 15 years her junior, attends law school in Southern California. She describes this marriage as the first healthy and successful relationship I've ever had in my life. In a long typewritten letter to me on May 11, 1994, Atkins wrote, 25 years ago, you tried 3 girls between the ages of 20 and 22 years old, and 1 35-year-old ex-con. Now, 25 years later, there are 3 women about the age of 45, all of whom have exemplary prison records, have taken advantage of the educational programs to earn college degrees, have contributed to every charity organization and program available, and have expressed remorse, shame, and regret for their parts in this hideous crime. And you have 1 60-year-old ex-con who shows up at his parole board hearings with a swastika carved on his forehead. I think that says it all. Though Atkins is very critical of Manson, she has said she still prays for him, that Charlie will turn to Christ. Atkins has obtained, through correspondence, an Associate of Arts degree, 2 years, graduating with a 3.5 grade point average. She also has completed a course in vocational data processing and is presently taking paralegal classes. Her current work assignment at Frontera is that of a sewing operator in the Prison Industries program. In 1976, Leslie Van Houten's conviction for the 2 LaBianca murders was reversed and sent back for a new trial by the California Court of Appeal, 2nd Appellate District, on the ground that Judge Charles Older had erred in not granting her motion for a mistrial when her attorney, Ronald Hughes, vanished near the end of the trial. After a hung jury in the first retrial, she was finally reconvicted of the 2 murders in 1978. As opposed to the guilt phase of her original trial back in 1970-71, in her 2 retrials, Van Houten readily admitted to the jury her full participation in the LaBianca homicides. Her defense was diminished mental capacity based on mental illness induced in part by the chronic, prolonged use of hallucinogenic drugs. For a few months before her last trial, she was released on a $200,000 bail bond paid for by friends and relatives, and lived for a while with a former writer from the Christian Science Monitor who was writing a book about Van Houten. The book reached the first draft level, but was never published. Van Houten had a short-lived marriage to a man named Bill Cywin in the early 80s. Though not connected to any misbehavior or complicity on her part, during the brief marriage, Cywin was found to be in possession of a female prison guard's uniform. Through correspondence courses, Van Houten acquired a Bachelor of Arts degree in English literature. She also writes short stories, one of which was included in an anthology of prison literature, and at one time edited the prison newspaper. She is part of a small inmate group that sews quilts for the homeless. Van Houten says she takes offense to the fact that Manson doesn't own up to his responsibility for the murders. I take responsibility for my part, and part of my responsibility was helping to create him. Being a follower does not excuse. Van Houten is presently doing secretarial work at the prison. Patricia Krenwinkel received a Bachelor of Science degree through correspondence while at Frontera and has also completed a course in vocational data processing. Krenwinkel has never married. The most athletic of the 3 Manson girls, she plays on the prison softball team and presently is a camp trainer in the inmate firefighters program, training those under her to meet a physical fitness standard they must have in order to fight fires. Both she and Van Houten serve as counselors in a program in which young people with drug abuse problems are brought to the prison. In 1988, while stating her deep remorse for the murders, Krenwinkel nonetheless told her prison psychiatrist that Abigail Folger, the person she murdered on the night of the Tate murders, could have been something more than she was, a drug abuser. At her 1993 parole hearing, Krenwinkel, crying and her voice cracking, told the board, "No matter what I do, I cannot change 1 minute of my life. There's nothing I can do outside of being dead to pay for this. And I know that's what you wish. But I cannot take my own life." In the 1994 ABC special, she said that every day I wake up and know that I'm a destroyer of the most precious thing, which is life, and living with that is the most difficult thing of all. But, she adds, that's what I deserve, to wake up every morning and know that. Responding to Manson's claim he did not order the murders, she said, Charlie is absolutely lying. There wasn't one thing done that was even allowed to be done without his express permission. She is very concerned about young people who write her and seem to think that what we did was all right. There is nothing, nothing that we did that is all right. Nothing. If there is anything I can say to these children, it's that he, Manson, is not the man to follow. All other family members convicted of Manson-related murders, with the exception of one, are also still behind bars. Bruce Davis, convicted of the murders of Donald Shorty Shea and Gary Hinman, is presently at the California Men's Colony at San Luis Obispo, California. And Robert Beausoleil, also convicted of the Hinman murder, is at the California Correctional Center at Susanville, California. Only Stephen Grogan, Clem Tufts in the family, convicted of Shea's murder, has been released. Grogan was by all accounts the most unhinged and spaced out, on psychedelic drugs, of all Manson family members. Even in the family he was considered crazy. Yet the transformation behind bars for Grogan, 18 years old at the time he participated in Shea's murder, was remarkable. Bert Katz, who prosecuted Grogan and is now a retired Los Angeles County Superior Court judge, says he was favorably impressed by the change in the openly remorseful Grogan and felt he had matured into a thoughtful, sensitive young man. Sergeant William Gleason of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, a lead investigator in the Shea murder, was similarly impressed, calling the change in Grogan amazing. Grogan became very adept behind bars at painting watercolors and playing his guitar, and obtained an airplane engine mechanic's license. One of the enduring Manson family mysteries was cleared up by Grogan. It had become part of Manson family lore, possibly to frighten all members who had a mutinous thought, that Shea was decapitated by Grogan and had been cut up and buried in 9 separate places at Spawn Ranch. However, extensive digging at the ranch by law enforcement had failed to uncover Shea or any part of him. In 1977, Grogan, while at the Dual Vocational Institution at Tracy, California, asked to see Katz. Determined to prove he had not beheaded Shea and that Shea had not been cut up into 9 pieces, he drew a map for Katz, pinpointing the location of Shea's body. Subsequently, Sergeant Gleason and his partner found Shea's remains in 1 piece at the spot designated by Grogan, the bottom of a steep embankment about a quarter mile down the road from the ranch. On November 18, 1985, Grogan was released from prison and was discharged from parole on April 13, 1988. Although Manson today has far more supporters and sympathizers than ever were members of his family, I know of no group at the present time, in or out of prison, calling themselves the Manson family and trying to keep the flame alive. The nomadic band of minstrels, waifs, and latent killers he assembled around him in the late 60s is no more, and no new group has emerged to take their place. With 2 exceptions, all of his former followers have severed their umbilical cord to him, starting new lives. Only Squeaky and Sandra, Red and Blue, Manson calls them, their faces still suffused with a missionary glow, have remained irrevocably wedded to him and still fervently preach his gospel. Squeaky has served most of her life sentence at the Federal Correctional Institution at Alderson, West Virginia. She is presently at the Federal Correctional Institution at Marianna, Florida, transferred there from Alderson on March 3, 1989. Sometime back, the Associated Press reported her saying that the curtain is about to come down on all of us, and if we don't turn everything over to Charlie immediately, it's going to be too late. In a 1977 unpublished manuscript about her life with Manson, Squeaky wrote, "People said that I was Manson's main woman. But Manson's main woman is the truth. She comes before anyone or anything, and he's with her always in life or death. When Squeaky learned on December 23, 1987, that Manson had written to some friends in Ava, Missouri that he had testicular cancer, Manson's personal medical records being confidential, the California Department of Corrections said they cannot confirm whether Manson in fact had or presently has the cancer. She escaped within hours from Alderson to come to him, but was apprehended a few days later only 2 miles away. In a letter to a friend earlier that month, she wrote, "I only live and feel alive when I think of him." Sandra Good served 10 years, five of which, from 1980 to 1985, she spent with Squeaky at Alderson, of her 15-year sentence. She now lives in Hanford, California, a town near Manson's prison at Corcoran. Though she does not have visiting privileges, she is content to be geographically close to Manson and has become the main spokesperson and cheerleader for him on the outside, telling whoever will listen, including national television audiences, that Manson is innocent of the Tate-LaBianca murders and would be a fantastic person for the country to follow, one who would give the children back to themselves. Good's boyfriend, George Simpson, does have visiting privileges, and reportedly is an intermediary for Manson. Good is believed to be the proud guardian of the vest Manson frequently wore during the family's heyday, embroidered by Charlie's girls through the years with the images of devils, witches, goblins, and other symbols of black magic and demonology. Also sewn into the vest is the hair of those girls who shaved their heads while conducting their round-the-clock vigil for Manson outside the Hall of Justice during his trial. As to those who were once members of Manson's flock or associated with the family, they have scattered to the four winds and are very protective of their privacy from the media. Because the Manson family has become synonymous with terror, like those in the Bible's Revelation 9, whose identifying seal on their foreheads their leader often spoke about, all of its former members, even those who, as far as we know, did not participate in any of the execrable crimes committed by the family, are marked for life. Since they know that few who are aware of their background can ever feel serene in their presence, nearly all of them keep their history a secret in their new lives. My latest information is that Linda Kasabian moved from New Hampshire and is now living under an assumed name in the Pacific Northwest with her husband and 3 children. A friend of Linda's when she lived in Milford, New Hampshire, told a reporter that Linda led a normal life. She drove her kids to school, participated in the PTA, that sort of thing. Barbara Hoyt, whom I was happy to help get into nursing school, is now a registered nurse in the Northwest. Barbara is divorced and living with her daughter in a townhouse she just purchased. She leads a very active life, camping, fishing, painting, and playing volleyball. Contrary to other reports, Diane Lake never became a corporate executive or vice president of a bank. She worked as a bank teller for years and describes herself today as a happily married, well-adjusted, and committed Christian living with my husband and 3 children in the western part of the United States. Kitty Lutzinger is divorced and raising her 2 children in California. Steve Grogan is not, as has been reported, working as a house painter in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles. Someone very close to him informed me that his occupation, undisclosed, takes him to various states, and he is doing exceptionally well, better than anyone could have anticipated. Mary Brunner, the first female member of the family, who was an assistant librarian at the University of California at Berkeley when she joined Manson, served 6.5 years for her participation in the Western Surplus store robbery in Hawthorne, California. She is presently living in the Midwest under an assumed name, is single, and is doing clerical work. Catherine Scher served 5 years for her conviction in the Hawthorne robbery. She now lives in a southwest state with her 2nd husband and a 23-year-old son who is a senior in college. After divorcing Manson family associate Kenneth Como in 1981, she says she completely separated herself from the family. Like Diane Lake, she says she is happily married and a Christian, very active in church affairs. Cher, who was born in Paris to a Hungarian violinist father and German-Jewish refugee mother, both of whom were members of the anti-Nazi underground French resistance during the Second World War, describes her life today as so clean she hasn't gotten a traffic ticket in 10 years. And like Patricia Krenwinkel and other former family members, she is deeply concerned about the many young people today who look up to Manson and want to follow him. Because of this, she is in the process of working on a book. She Was a Gypsy Woman, with a Texas-based writer, which will tell the truth to these youths about who Charles Manson really is. During the penalty phase of the Tate-LaBianca trial, Cher had testified that the motive for the murders was not helter-skelter, which I had tied firmly to Manson, but the so-called copycat motive, which had nothing to do with Manson. In a conversation with her in early April of 1994, she acknowledged to me what I had already known, that her testimony was untruthful. She said the copycat motive story, as well, of course, as her testimony that Linda Kasabian, not Manson, had been behind the murders, was a fabrication to save Manson from the gas chamber, and that she had testified to it under his explicit direction. Catherine Gillies is divorced and living on welfare with her 4 children near Death Valley. She is very proud of the fact that her 2 teenage daughters are both honor students. No one seems to know what became of Stephanie Schramm. Nancy Pittman married Michael Monfort, a former member of the Aryan Brotherhood, a group Manson allegedly had a loose, arm's-length relationship with in the mid-70s. She served 1 year for her accessory after-the-fact conviction in the murder of Lauren Willett, a homicide Monfort pled guilty to. Pittman divorced Monfort in 1990. She is now single, employed, and living with her 4 children in the Pacific Northwest. Her main concern these days, she says, is to protect my children from any harm brought about by her having once belonged to the Manson family. Little Paul Watkins, the intelligent and articulate youth who provided me with the missing link for Manson's motive of helter-skelter, died in 1990 from leukemia. Paul and his second wife, Martha, had 2 girls and lived in Tecopa, a small desert town at the southernmost edge of Death Valley. Paul was the founder and first president of the Death Valley Chamber of Commerce and the unofficial mayor of Tecopa. He and his wife mined rocks in the area and sold them in their Tecopa jewelry store. Paul also lectured extensively on the psychology of cults and the pernicious effects of substance abuse. His book, My Life with Charles Manson, was published in 1979. For years, Paul, who composed, sang, and played the saxophone and flute, and his close friend Brooks Poston, composition, guitar, had a rock band called the Desert Sun that played at night spots in the Death Valley area. Brooks, the self-described hayseed from Texas, is now reportedly a member of a non-violent cult in New Orleans, but I have been unable to confirm this. Dennis Rice served 5 years for the Hawthorne robbery and an additional 2 for violating a condition of his parole that he stop associating with members of the Manson family. Today he is an ordained minister and president of Free Indeed Ministries, Incorporated. He lives with his second wife in a southwest state and speaks, he says, in high schools, jails, and prisons all over America on the power of Jesus Christ to change lives. He has 6 children, all of whom, he notes proudly, are Christians serving God. Ruth Morehouse is living with her husband and 3 children in a Midwestern state. The Panamanian cowboy Juan Flynn returned to Panama, where he works on a ranch. In early 1994, Juan returned to the Death Valley area to visit old friends. In the late 70s, I received a call from Canadian law enforcement looking for Danny DiCarlo, who was born in Canada. I have been unable to find out from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Ottawa what became of this matter, because the Privacy Act in Canada prohibits the release of this information. I have no idea where DiCarlo is today. I am frequently asked what happened to the Manson children. There were 8 of them. 4 belonging to Dennis Rice by his first wife, 3 boys and a girl. Two of Rice's boys are now pastors in churches located in a Southwest state. The other boy and the girl also live in the Southwest and are very involved in the activities of their local Christian church. Little is known of Sandra Good's son, Sunstone Hawk, except that he went to college on a football scholarship and was a lineman on the team. Linda Kasabian's daughter Tanya grew up with Linda in New Hampshire. She now lives in the Pacific Northwest, is married, and recently made Linda a grandmother with her first child. All I was able to learn about Susan Atkins' son, Zizo Zoe Zadfrak, was that he was adopted, reportedly by a physician. The court records have been sealed, and Atkins herself does not know where her son is. Valentine Michael, Pooh Bear, the son of Manson and Mary Brunner, was raised by Mary's parents in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Until the third grade, he did not know who his father was and believed his mother to be his older sister. In 1993, Michael told a reporter who tracked him down that he had never visited Manson, nor do I have any desire to see him. He's just some evil person I have nothing to do with. According to Manson family researcher Bill Nelson, Michael, now 26, lives with his girlfriend and their 3-year-old son in a Rocky Mountain state where he is a salesman for a plumbing supply firm. He recently got his real estate license. Michael is deeply appreciative of the fact that his grandparents raised him, and to this day remains closer to them than to his mother. As to some of those whose lives brought them into contact with Manson and his family in a significant way, Doris Day's son, record producer Terry Melcher, at whose former home the Tate murders took place and whom Manson unsuccessfully sought to have record him and his music, is now primarily in the hotel and real estate business on the West Coast. He continues, however, to be involved in the music world. Since 1985, he has been the producer of the Beach Boys recordings. Terry and his wife have become quite active in the civic affairs of the community in which they live. Greg Jacobson, who met Manson at Dennis Wilson's home and was the one who introduced Melcher to Manson, whose philosophy on life he found intellectually stimulating, is, to quote him, half-retired and leading the good life in the charming Oceanside community of Laguna Beach, California. Greg and his wife, comic Lou Costello's daughter, divorced, and he is not remarried. He is the part owner of a Chinese restaurant in nearby Newport Beach, buys and sells antiques, and does a little music composition working with local musicians. Dennis Wilson, the drummer for the Beach Boys, at whose home on Sunset Boulevard Manson, without invitation, moved into with his family in the late spring of 1968, and who told me when I sought musical tapes he had made of Manson that he had destroyed them because the vibrations connected with them don't belong to this earth, drowned on December 27, 1983, at Marina Del Rey, California, while diving off a dock near a friend's boat. The coroner's report provided a possible explanation for the drowning. The alcohol level in Wilson's blood was 0.26%, nearly 3 times the legal limit for operating a motor vehicle in the state of California. Traces of cocaine and Valium were also found in his system. Guns N' Roses wasn't the first rock group to record a Manson song. With minor changes in the lyrics, e.g. exist was changed to resist, brother to lover, Manson's composition Cease to Exist was recorded by the Beach Boys and released on the B-side of Bluebirds Over the Mountain on December 8, 1968, under the new title Never Learn Not to Love. The single never got past number 61 on the charts, but both sides of the 45 RPM were included in 2020, the Beach Boys' last album with Capitol Records the following year. Although the Beach Boys never credited Manson as being the composer, Paul Watkins, Brooks Poston, and Greg Jacobson each confirmed to me it was Manson's song. And in the 1986 biography of the Beach Boys, Heroes and Villains, The True Story of the Beach Boys, author Stephen Gaines acknowledges this. Mike Rubin, a New York City writer who has been tracking the rock music scene in America for years, says that in addition to Guns N' Roses, he knows of at least 5 other rock groups who have either recorded a song of Manson's or a Manson tribute song within the past decade. In early January of 1994, the industrial hard rock group Nine Inch Nails recorded their most recent album, Downward Spiral, at the former Tate residence. Trent Reznor, lead singer and songwriter for the band, says that although he called the jerry-built studio constructed for the recordings of the album Le Pig, and although there were songs in the album like Piggy and March of the Pigs, with confrontational lyrics, the word pig was printed in blood by the killers on the front door of the Tate residence, and the words Death to Pigs on the living room wall of the LaBianca residence, this was all a coincidence. That the realtor through whom he leased the home failed to tell him it had been the scene of the Tate murders. The Le Pig studio was also used by a hard rock group called Marilyn Manson, in which lead singer Mr. Manson recorded the vocals for its soon-to-be-released album, Portrait of an American Family. George Spawn didn't much care for the rainy Oregon weather, nor the ranch he bought there in 1971, and after a year returned to Los Angeles and moved back with his wife, from whom he had been legally separated. Spawn died in late 1974 at the age of 85. One of Spawn's daughters told me that Ruby Pearl, the one-time circus bareback rider and horse wrangler who helped Spawn run the ranch, had accompanied Spawn to Oregon. She bought a smaller ranch in Oregon after Spawn reunited with his wife and is still living there. In 1979, Ronnie Howard died in a Los Angeles hospital from injuries sustained in a beating by two unknown male assailants. Lawrence Merrick, who produced the 1970 Academy Award-nominated documentary Manson, was shot to death in 1977 at his Hollywood studio. The police concluded that both murders were unrelated to Manson or his family. After she resolved her parole problems, Virginia Graham opened up a health spa at the Hilton Hawaiian Village Hotel in Honolulu with the $12,000 she received as her share from the Polanski reward money. A survivor, Virginia today is the manager of a fine art gallery in Kailua Kona, Hawaii, and just completed a much-expanded version of her 1974 book, The Joy of Hooking, titled Look Who is Sleeping in My Bed, Madams, Mansions, Murder, and Manson. I appreciated what she said about me in her 1974 book, especially in view of Manson's familiar refrain that I railroaded him. She wrote, I can't remember how many times we went down to the district attorney's office to go over my statement with Vincent Bugliosi. I have to say this about Bugliosi. Although I've never had much love for authority of any kind, he was absolutely fair, straight, and honest. He never once even hinted that I might alter my testimony a little bit to help the state's case. He was careful to the other extreme, in fact. Spawn Ranch was never rebuilt after it was burned to the ground by brush fires that swept the area from Newhall to the sea in September of 1970. The German company that bought the land from George Spawn never developed it into the Dude Ranch resort for German tourists they had planned. Today there are no signs that the murderous Manson family was ever there. All of the ramshackle structures on the ranch are gone, and the property, which was eventually sold to the state of California, is deserted, weed-choked land. The Tate residence went through several owners after Rudy Altobelli, the landlord at the time of the murders. The current owner tore the house down in January of 1994 because he didn't like the history of the place, and is in the process of constructing an enormous $10 million home that will tower over all other homes in the area. The LaBianca home was owned for years by a Filipino couple, the wife reportedly being a friend of Imelda Marcos. They sold it recently to their daughter and son-in-law. As for the Manson trial participants today, Irving Kenrick, Manson's lawyer, was ordered to be inactive by the California State Bar on January 29, 1990. He resigned from the bar on October 26, 1990, with charges pending. I do not know the basis for the charges, being a privileged matter, nor Kenrick's present whereabouts. Paul Fitzgerald, Patricia Krenwinkel's lawyer, practices law in Beverly Hills and is a prominent member of the Criminal Defense Bar in the Los Angeles area. Fitzgerald, a fine trial lawyer who continues to win more than his share of cases, manages to do so without sacrificing grace and civility in the courtroom, a place inherently inhospitable to both qualities. Day Shin, Susan Atkins' lawyer, was disbarred by the California State Bar on October 16, 1992, for misappropriating a client's money. Maxwell Keith, the urbane lawyer who replaced Ronald Hughes as Leslie Van Houten's lawyer, is still in the private practice of law in Los Angeles, and this year was honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Los Angeles Criminal Courts Bar Association. The cause of Ronald Hughes' death in the Sespe Hot Springs area of Ventura County remains a mystery to this day. In 1976, a former member of Manson's family, understandably wanting to remain anonymous, called me. Without furnishing any additional or supporting information, he stated categorically that Hughes had been murdered by the Manson family. Lieutenant Greg Husband of the Ventura County Sheriff's Office reports that since it was never determined whether Hughes' death was the result of an accident, homicide, or suicide, the Hughes case file is still open, though no investigators are presently assigned to the case. It should be remembered that there is no statute of limitations for the crime of murder. I write almost full-time, trying cases on a very selective basis. My two most recent nonfiction books, both published in 1991, are And the Sea Will Tell and Drugs in America, The Case for Victory. I'm presently writing a book on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. My read on the case? Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy and acted alone. Kurt Gentry, the co-author of this book, went on to write J. Edgar Hoover, The Man and the Secrets. Published in 1991, it is the definitive biography of Hoover, and in my opinion, and that of many others, a literary tour de force. My co-prosecutor, Aaron Stovitz, has always wanted, and I feel is still eminently qualified, to be a judge. In October of 1991, Aaron, who was retired from the DA's office, became a part-time Los Angeles Municipal Court Commissioner in San Fernando, a city in the northeast section of Los Angeles County. His sense of humor intact, Aaron says he is the Judge Wapner of the San Fernando Valley, and orders anyone who comes to his small claims court unprepared to watch two reruns of People's Court. Judge Charles Older is in retirement, having left the bench in 1987. In a three-volume work by J. Robert Nash called Bloodletters and Bad Men, a who's who of virtually every well-known criminal in American history, Jesse James is on the cover of Volume 1, Al Capone on Volume 2, and Manson on Volume 3. In the elite pantheon of heinous criminals, Manson has made his mark, and he appears to relish this fame, as steeped in infamy as it is. In the 25 years that have elapsed since the atrocities which Charles Manson ordered and masterminded occurred, mass murder, as never before, has almost become a staple in our society. Disgruntled or demented killers flip out, go into a former place of employment, fast food establishment, law firm, etc., and murder 5 to 10 people or more. Such carnage no longer shocks a desensitized public when reported on the evening news. But fortunately, as of this date, the singularity of Manson's evil and the particular brand of demonic murders he authored have not again been inflicted upon our nation. We can only hope that the ensuing years will be the same. V.B., June 1994.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Helter Skelter, The True Story of the Manson Murders. Written by Vincent Bugliosi with Kurt Gentry. Narrated by Scott Brick. Executive Producer, Christina Harkar. Producer, Mike Charzik. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1974 by Kurt Gentry and Vincent Bugliosi. Afterword copyright 1994 by Vincent Bugliosi. Production copyright 1994. 2011 by Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.